I want to thank the committee, though. I'm really honored that they thought of me and thought that I had something to share, you know, and I'm truly going to try and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's nice to see so many people in here who could relate to this topic. So I think that's kind of cool. I do want to, the question should have been, who in this room going to do the second half of this workshop? That's what the question should have been. But I'm sure they'll work that out, because I'm going to time myself. I do want to start off by saying that I'm one of five children my parents had, and I was the good one, seriously. The good girl. I was the one who, look, I'm just sharing my story, you know, but I'm telling you that I was the one who did not hang out in the street, you know, who did well in school, who was very shy. I'm still shy, who's very shy. And I'm still learning how to speak slang. I know I heard the previous speaker talk about that, you know. So I was very unique in my family. The rest of my family, my two sisters and my two brothers hang out on the corner. They had a ton of friends. They were very street savvy. And I just wasn't built like that. You know, even my sponsor told me, once while we were doing some stuff work, she said I was an addict with no skills because I didn't know how to shoplift and, you know, I just didn't have those kind of skills. So as it turned out, I did develop a skill, though, while I was using. I was a driver, okay? So as long as I had a car, I was all right, right? So I used to drive the car. My brother was, oh my God, rest his soul. My brother was killed, stabbed to death in my first year clean as a result of his addiction. But I used to hang out with him and drive and be the lookout. Oh, I did look out too. I did look out too at 7-Eleven while he stole cigarettes. So I have some skills. And I used to drive, you know, the people wanting to get high back and forth across 14th Street Bridge into D.C. And, you know, even hanging out on the corners of Washington, D.C., I could see that I was very unique. I'm just telling my story. I was, you know. So I compared myself out. I wasn't like all the other addicts that hung out on the corners of 14th Street trying to cop. As a matter of fact, I couldn't even cop. I had to always send somebody else or go with them, you know? So, after a while, though, like, into my addiction, I was finally like, I got to do something about this because I was getting beat sometimes, you know? So every time I tried to cop, people would look at me and go, you sure you want to be here? I mean, and I think I developed some skills at the end. You know, I really did. I remember one time, oh my God, I could not get high. I don't know. Maybe I didn't have a car. I was on the side of the street at that point, but I could not figure out. Oh no, I did have a car, but my brother was locked up. That's what that was. But I kept looking around the house trying to figure out what could I sell that nobody would, you know, miss. Like, I couldn't take the TV or the microwave or anything like that. So I found this camera. And, you know, it was an old camera, but I said, you know, one of them people over in D.C. gonna want this camera. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm in D.C. trying to sell this dumb camera. And nobody bought it. I had to get back in the car and come on back home. But it was really, now that I'm thinking about it, it was really rough on me trying to get high, okay? It was so hard. It was very difficult. So I struggled with that a lot. Anyway, towards the end of my addiction, what happened was I was hanging out, let me tell you that the reason that I used is because I really wanted to fit in. You know, I felt different. You know, I just really wanted to fit in. And I used to see my two brothers get high from shooting dope all the time, and they looked so happy and peaceful in a nod. And I wanted to be in a nod too. And I just wanted to be a part of, you know? I just wanted to feel like, I just wanted to just feel like I fit in. I felt so odd and so different. And so I used to beg my brother to let me shoot dope, and he would always say, no, you do not want to do this. And of course, the more he said that, the more I wanted to do it. And so finally, you know what, I think that he finally said hi because I had, I mean, said yes because I had the money that day, right? So I shot some dope, and he used to hang around this guy that I had a crush on. So they would always get high together. So I got high, I got attention, and that's how it was. And I felt like I finally fit in when I OD'd. And I felt, when I think about that now, I think about how sick that is. I was like, oh my God, I've arrived. I've OD'd. You know, talk about somebody in need of attention, right? And I just thank God that I didn't die, because I OD'd twice. But, you know, so I was the driver most of the time, but this one particular time at the end of my addiction, I was hanging out with my brother, my oldest brother, the one I told you isn't with us anymore, and he was hanging out with this other guy. And they let me go hang out with them. They stole this lady's purse. I was with them. I hung out with them all day long. We took her bank card to the bank and got money out of the machine. And that time, they found a way to beat the, I don't know, money came out. That's all I know. And so we got high, like, running the streets all day long. So 4 o'clock in the morning, my brother says he's going in, home, you know, wherever he was staying at that time. And me and this guy say, okay, you know, we dropped him off, and then we decided that we just needed to get high just one more time, 4 o'clock in the morning. So we went by the bank again because we didn't have any more money. And I was so stupid, let me just say that, because he said, the guy that I was with said, here, take the bank card and you put it in the machine and you do it and you hold it and you do everything. He had noticed the police sitting outside the bank. So I so gullible, you know. I did what he said. So when we left the bank and got into this car that he was driving, he hadn't dropped me off yet, got into his car and pulled out, as soon as we got out on the street, I think it must have been about 7 or 8 police cars surrounded us, told me to get out and lay down, face down in the street. Okay. Just let me tell you that I was shocked that I had to get out and lay down, face down in the street in the middle of the night, right? I mean, I was like in shock. And because, you know, I'm not supposed to be laying face down in the street. You know, I don't roll like that. So, oh, my God. So when they carted us off to Fairfax County Jail, and I know maybe, you know, most of y'all might not know about Fairfax County and their jail, you know, but I don't have a whole lot of experience with jail, but I knew that was a place I did not want to be. And they got me there, and, oh, my husband and my son was at home, by the way, you know. Oh, my God. So I get to Fairfax County Jail, and the way they treated me, I just want to tell you, I was absolutely appalled. No, seriously. They told me to put my hands on a wall and spread my legs. And what makes it so bad is I was crying. I put my hands on a wall, and she kicked my leg. Open your legs wider. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, mean. They were treating me like some kind of a criminal. I mean, I could not believe it. And that night at the jail, I thought I was gonna wake up the next morning and it all be like a nightmare. It still blows me away when I think about it, because even the bed, this is horrible. Even the bed that I had to sleep on didn't have a mattress. It was like a cinder block. Huh? So they keep you in there for a certain period of time, right? They didn't give me no pajamas or nothing. It was horrible. It was not good. That thing was not good at all. So when the dust settled the next morning and I realized that it was not a dream, you know, I'm trying to figure out, oh my God, I felt like a rat in a cage. You know, I was like, oh my God, how do I get out of this thing? So I eventually called up my parents. And by this time, my addiction was in full force. I wanted my father to take out a loan or something from his credit union. That's what it was. And he refused. And I'm his favorite child. I'm serious. I say that, but if you ask my siblings, they would tell you that I'm the favorite. So for me to have been treated like that, I was really appalled. So he didn't put up the loan, you know, he didn't bond me out. I couldn't figure out why my husband hadn't ran up there. So he finally showed up about 2 or 3 days later, right? And when I went to visit him in the visiting booth, what? He had the nerve to be pissed off. You know, he was mad. And I told him it didn't have anything, me hanging out in the middle of the night did not have anything to do with sex or another man. Y'all got that, right? I just needed to get high. That's all it was. Oh, he was so upset. You know what? It was more than upset. He looked at me like he didn't even love me. He looked at me like he was disgusted. And I could not understand how he could lose the love from, you know what I'm saying? I couldn't understand it. So, oh my God, the story gets so much worse. What happened was I had to wait until court because my parents refused to put up the money. And it took 32 days. I had to sit in jail to go to court. And what happened was I hadn't paid the rent. We were renting. I hadn't paid the rent. It had been about 3 months. And it wasn't the first time I had done that. So my husband and my son were evicted, sat out on the street while I was in jail doing that 30 days. Goodness. Addiction. I was so self-centered, I could not even see it. It blew me away. Obviously, even today, when I think about that piece, you know, I'm mad because he's mad. And they're getting evicted. So when I got out of jail, they had already moved into my parents' basement. And that's where I went. And they say self-centeredness is the core of this disease. And it was definitely in rare fashion at that point in my addiction. So I knew something was wrong. You know, I knew something was wrong. And you know what? During that 30 days in jail, I was calling back to the apartment before they were evicted. And my brother was in and out of there because he didn't really have any place to stay. And I was crying. I'm a crybaby. I know, y'all ain't know that, right? I was... And he was like, oh my God, he was, stop crying, stop. You know you a tuck, we soldiers. You know you a soldier, stop crying. And I was like, I don't want to be a soldier. Didn't want to be a soldier. Wow. He lost the battle, though, you know. I'm glad y'all told me. Y'all taught me I don't have to be a soldier. I don't want to be a soldier. I can't win that battle, you know. The only way I can is through the program Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm just so grateful for that. So eventually, I was court-ordered to do... outpatient treatment. I credit my counselor today to saving my life. She insisted that I do outpatient treatment, and then she insisted that I do it like during the week where eventually I got a job, and she wanted me to make that a priority and tell my job that I had to not work one day a week and go to outpatient therapy. I said, I can't tell them that. So, I don't know how she expected me to lose face and tell my job that I'm an addict and I need to go to outpatient therapy. Now, how that sound? So she told me I do that or I go to jail. I was treated so bad. Horribly. Again, horribly. So, anyway, I had no choice. I told them, you know, I ended up using after that, though. I went on a binge is what happened. So, I came back home after a couple days, and I still wanted my job. I wanted my job back. I liked that job. And I asked my husband, please call my job and talk to them and make something, tell them this and that. And he said, you would not believe what this man did. He got on the phone and called my job and told them that I relapsed and that I had been struggling, you know, talked to my boss and told them the truth. I don't know why people insist on treating me. When I tell them to do one thing, they do something else, right? But I'm just so grateful. To this program, because what happened was y'all helped me to grow up. You know, I've grown up in this program. I kept coming back. I did what y'all said. Somebody else, one of the speakers, though, I think the main speaker tonight, talked about the power of attraction, and that's what happened for me. I started going to meetings, and I saw people that I knew Actually, I saw people that hustled with my brother, and I knew how bad he was. So I said, if they're as bad as he was, and they're in their rooms, they look so happy. They were wearing gold, and they just look so happy. And I thought that if it helped them, then it's going to help me too. So I kept coming back, and during that time, the rooms were filled with smoke. You know, you could smoke in the meetings at that time. And I was confused, but I just kept coming back. I just knew that I needed to do something different. So I still felt lost, but I kept coming. And what happened was, doing like my first couple months clean, I love y'all so much because you do for me what I'm not willing to do for myself. You know, they say give her some service work. And I have been in service. By the grace of God, I have 21 years clean, May 16th. And I have been in service since I've been here. I haven't been perfect since I've been here. I've struggled since I've been here, you know, with some different issues. But I haven't picked up. But I can tell you, as a result of trying to live this program and practice principles, I'm getting better. One of the lessons I learned was actually just a few years ago. I was thinking about how long ago was that, because it seems like a totally different time in my life. I was in a totally different place. I thought that I did not want to be with my husband. I share this because it scares me when I think about my behavior at that time, and I don't want to ever forget it, don't want to ever repeat it. I thought I didn't want to be with him. I'm going to tell you the PG version, okay? I'm not going to tell you the X-rated version. So I thought I didn't want to be with him, and I have a really good network. I go to meetings. I work the steps. I help people. I pray. But during this time of my life, I screwed up. Let me just say that. I told my husband that I wanted a divorce. But the way that it came about was, it was not kind to him. And sold our first house, the first house that we had bought, sold it, because I just knew that this was what I wanted to do. I thought that I didn't have a way out. Emotionally, I felt like I needed something, wasn't sure what that something was, and trying to figure it out, I acted out. So we split up, sold the house, split the money. I moved into a townhouse with a lady until I could figure out what I wanted to do. And about 7 months or so into it, I found out that the feelings that I had, they still were there. You know, it wasn't him. I thought it was him. It wasn't him. It wasn't the house. It was me. So I looked up that day and just wondered, what had I done? You know, what the hell happened? What happened? God loves me so much. So much. And I have a good husband. So I called him. Now granted, I put this man through a lot. A lot. You know, like for 2 years or so. And I called him and I said, I want you back. And he was shocked, you know, because he didn't know whether to believe me or not based on my behavior, you know. To make a long story short, because I'm running out of time, he said, come talk about it. Okay, I went to talk to him in his apartment that he got, right? And he wanted to ask me all these daggone questions trying to grill me. I couldn't believe it. How do I know I'm ready and all this stuff, right? Anyway, He finally agreed. I said, okay, got my way, you know, my head. Got my husband back. I was scared, really, somebody else was going to get him because he's good to me, you know. So he called me up at work but I could feel like something wasn't right, you know, with him, with his feelings, his love for me. And he called me up at work about a weekend after that and told me while I was standing up at work that he changed his mind. He did not want to be with me. And I could not believe it. My whole world fell apart, you know, emotionally. Because I did it. Actually, what happened was, even before I called him and asked him to take me back, I was sitting there reading The Triangle of Self-Obsession and some other pamphlets, and in it talked about how I've never learned how to accept the word no, and it just blew me away. I mean, it just really blew me away. So anyway, the reason that I know that God loves me is because I talk to my friends about it so much. I have some really good friends. But even they couldn't pull me off that ledge. So one of my really good girlfriends told me, okay, he said no. So what you have to do is you have to leave all dudes alone. Don't mess with nobody, and be the best wife that you can be without your husband. And I said, what? And I did that. I thought about it. I didn't want to do it. You know, that didn't seem fair. But I did it. And what made it so bad, I told him that that's what I was going to do. I wrote him a letter and told him that I accept that what he told me was the word no. I said, but I'm letting you know that I'm going to be here for you. And I'm going to be the best wife that I can be, even if you're not here. So that was not fun. But about 6 months after that, he called me up and wanted to see me. Told me he loved me. He wanted me back. And I haven't looked back since. So I just want to thank y'all for helping me to grow up. You know, because I think that I'm just so unique that the rules do not apply to me. The rules apply to me. Well. Thank y'all for letting me share.
All right. Thanks, Nisha, for sharing. Our next speaker is Eric P.
I'm an addict. My name is Eric. And it's by God's grace and his mercy that I'm able to stand here clean tonight.
Me still going off.
And first of all, I want to thank some of my friends who convinced me to come up here and do this as a replacement, because not only am I not emotionally prepared to do this, I've been going through some of my own personal battles. And it's all centered around the topic being or was unique. I'm an addict in every sense of the word, and my clean date is April 1st, 1989, and on that day, I realized I was the biggest fool I had ever been in my life that was out there using drugs. You know, I also want to share with you all that for a lot of years that while I used, I didn't think that I was an addict. See, my idea of an addict was somebody who shot dope in his arms, had big puffy hands, and nodded out and lived on the streets and so forth and so on. And I would be getting high, sitting across from guys who were dropping from ODs, and I would be saying, look how crazy they are. Because I was in complete denial about the nature of the disease of addiction. You know, I was one of them guys who work throughout his addiction. You know, I felt like if I couldn't work to support my habit, I didn't need a habit. And so that left me in a lot of denial for a lot of years because I could, no matter how bad it got, I always had something to fall back to, something that would pull me out of. And I always thought it was me that was always doing it. I'm here to tell you that's what made me the biggest fool. You know, so the last 5 years after getting to the rooms, the last 5 years that I was using, I realized that I wanted to stop several times and didn't know how. You know, and I had convinced myself that I could stop whenever I could, wanted to, but I never could do it on a consistent basis, or I could never make it last more than a month at a time. So it took a counselor through my job to explain to me that I had been using for years. And see, I didn't think smoking weed was using. I understood smoking crack was using, but I didn't think drinking was using. See, so my mind and my understanding was distorted in a delusion that I was better than those who I thought were addicts. So, yes, I was unique in that sense, you know. And even after going to treatment, and this is the story, I went to treatment to get some help, but I wanted to tell them how to help me. I wanted to tell them the way they should run their program and how they should, you know, let me stay in this program and to do the things that's going to fit me personally. And there was 100 more addicts in that room, in that place. And when they didn't want to do what I wanted them to do, I got mad. And I said, I'm leaving. I was up in Pennsylvania, up in the mountains somewhere, and at the bottom of that mountain was a highway, and it was 8 o'clock at night, and it was dark. Where was I going to go? No money in my pocket, no understanding of what the disease had taken me through, no understanding of who I really was because I had been using for so many years that me nor me was not even real. And what happened was, you know, we had a group up in that facility, and they were called chronics. Those were people who had habitually used and came back into treatment several times. And this one guy sat me down before I could walk out the door, and what he shared with me was that you don't really want to leave. You want to use, and you're too much of a punk to say it. And I looked at him with some disdain in my face, like, you don't know me. But he knew exactly who I was. You know, and he called me out, and at the end of that two-hour conversation with a guy who was about to leave, he shared his story with me, and it helped me realize that I had an issue. You know, and I stayed those 30 days, you know, and you know, the weight came back on, and the skin color had changed, and the wife didn't leave, you know, and I must tell you, I was married, there was a house, there was cars, there was money, but it wasn't anything that I had done. And so when I got home, the only thing I wanted to do was go to meetings. I had an understanding and a secret understanding that I'm not going to do any step work. I'm not going to tell you people my business. And I'm just going to be all right staying clean. You know, and I had a sponsor and I had a network of people in my life. And I'm going to tell you, these guys, as far as I'm concerned today, they was the greatest group of guys I could ever be around. Because they had no cut cards. They was going to tell me about me whether I solicited their advice or not. And so I was going through this process, and I'm saying it's a process because I came in here with a lot of secrets. And for the first year and a half, I kept those secrets. I was having affairs. I was running the streets. I was doing everything that a using addict would do but use. You know, and I thought I was all right. You know, so when the wife got tired of me at the end of the second year, she left, and my whole world changed. I was shattered. See, I was validating my means and my purpose through the understanding of what someone else felt about me. I had no esteem. I had no dignity. I had no integrity. I had no self-respect. You know, I was devastated when she left, and instead of me embracing the opportunity to change, I went on a rampage. And for the next 18 months, I lied, I tricked, I stole, I cheated, I cussed people out, and I went to meetings every day. I had keys to a facility that I had to close after the last meeting that night, 5 days a week, and I thought I was better than y'all because they was trusting me, you know? They was doing things, they was allowing me to do things, and I was taking on service positions, and I wasn't fulfilling the service commitments. And I'm going to say this because I was the treasurer for an area, and I wasn't even paying the area's bills. I wasn't stealing the money, but and I thought it was all right. I'm going to meetings. Y'all money here. Y'all can get it anytime. I mean, real arrogant, real defiant. Had no understanding of the principles that I was trying to live by, but thinking that I was doing it real well. So that was done, and the money was spent, and the cars was gone, and the house was gone, and I was left with just me. And I'm going to share this because all that took place, but it took place after my sponsor had sat me down after the wife had left, and this is what he said. He asked me a question. He said, you know, your situation's changed. What you going to do about it? And the arrogant guy that I was and can be still today was, she left. I'm going to do me. I'm all right. He said, okay. He says, well, I'm going to tell you now, if you don't change who you are, if you don't change your understanding of who you are, God's going to take everything that you value away from you, and you're going to be left with yourself. And that happened. After those 18 months, I hit a bottom. After the bottom, we all think that the bottoms come as a result of using. The bottoms can come in this program as a result of not living the principles. I hit a bottom clean. It was the most devastating thing that I could ever have gone through clean. You know, and I've had some other issues. I've been divorced twice in this program. I've lost jobs in this program. I mean, I've gone through enough. I've lost both parents clean. But that was the most devastating thing that could ever happen to me because I thought that I had control over the nature of this disease. And it was surfacing in other areas, and I didn't understand that it was surfacing in other areas because I wasn't doing any work on me. At the end of those 18 months, after not having that vehicle that I valued, you know, because that validated who I was, you know, the things that I had, the places I could go, the clothes that I could wear, you know, jewelry, you know, the people I could hang around. That's what validated me. And when all of that was gone and I was left with me, I broke down like a baby. And for the first time in my whole adult life that I can remember, I started crying in public. And it didn't matter what you thought. My image was not important at that time. And I got off that subway train after working a 14-hour day. I didn't want to go to a meeting. And I ran four blocks to my house, and I dropped to my knees, and I asked for some help. I called out to my higher power, and I asked for some help. And about 15 minutes after I got up off my knees, my sponsor called, and he asked me was all right. And for the first time in that relationship, I told him the truth. No. I said, no, I'm not all right. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, my image was no longer in play. I couldn't live and go through life as I was going through it. I got a good friend of mine who says it all the time. He said, if opportunity and compulsion had crossed the street at the same time during that episode, I would have used. I would have picked up. And my arrogance and my understanding of who I was at that time would have not allowed me to come back here. I would not have had a straight amount of years of clean time because I was not going to let you people say I told you so. Fortunately, he came by, and when I first came around, we didn't have a step working guide. You know, so the step working guide that I was given was created by my grand sponsor, and it was about probably a half inch thick, and it had three sections: childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. And in each one of those sections, it asks the same question: how did you feel when you got high? How did you feel when you was being abused? What means would you go to get high if you were still getting high? I mean, it was each one of those areas. And it was the same question. And for each stage of life, as I understand today, the answers couldn't have been the same, because if they had always been the same, you know, that would have meant that I would have never grown up. But the truth is that I had not grown up from the very point that I started using to the point that I stopped using. And I was still acting out like I was a child because I was a grown man who hadn't grown up in this grown man's body and didn't understand who I was. And I didn't understand what life was about, and I didn't understand who I was supposed to be or what I was supposed to become. So I was being asked these questions repetitively. I was being asked the same questions over and over and over again. And I began to understand that the process was about building character, not having characters. I came in here with a lot of different characters. My characters would allow me to fit any situation. My sponsor said that I was a secret agent. You know, I wasn't going to let you know who I was, but the truth is, how could I let you know if I didn't know? You know, so he would always say that you got to talk to me. You have to share who you are. You have to let people know where you are and what you're feeling. You know, and so being a secret agent was comfortable for me because it kept you just close enough but far enough that if you thought that you might have wanted to help me, you couldn't get any closer to help me. And so at the end of taking that guide from him and beginning to do some work in the process of getting back to the point where I was beginning to like me again, because I'm here to tell you that at the end of that time frame, I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror. And I'm talking about not even being able to look at myself in the mirror clean, you know. But beginning to understand that being clean was not going to be enough. That I was really not different from you all. And see, that's where the uniqueness showed up, because I still thought that I was a little different. I, like I said, I didn't shoot dope in my veins, but I smoked on a daily basis. You know, I drank on a daily basis. And because I had a job, you know, I didn't have to go out here and steal and rob and maim other individuals, because my job was supporting my habits. So I thought I was different. I thought I was a cut above. I thought I was a high-bottom dope fiend. But the truth is, I was just an addict, plain and simple. An addict is an addict is an addict. There's no different levels for the addiction. We might do different things to get there, but at the end of the day, we all suffer from grave emotional despair. You know, I heard Niecy talking about being a young, in a family of five. I was the youngest of five children. I have two sisters and two brothers, and, you know, being the youngest, you know, and being picked on, all of that played a part in the esteem issues that I took on. You know, I couldn't understand how family could do you bad, you know. And then when you hanging out with your fellas, and, you know, you thinking that you're getting more love from them as long as you're doing what they're doing to fit in, you think that you're okay. And that's what my life was. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be validated. I wanted to be okay. I wanted to fit into a groove. You know, it's like a puzzle. I wanted to be part of the puzzle, whether it was good or bad. I just wanted something that would work for me to make me feel good outside of me. And that's what I got. And so when I started doing this stuff called step work, because this is important that we do some step work. When I started doing the stuff called step work, the things that I thought was important, like the cars and the money and the clothes and, you know, the houses and all that, became trivial. It wasn't that important. You know, because the thing that I found out that I had been seeking the whole time was some self-respect, some dignity, some self-worthiness. You know, I learned, you know, in this process that truth and honesty are not the same things. You know, and I started having to look at my life in terms of truths. You know, it's a truth that I used on a daily basis. It's a truth that I harmed other individuals when I used on a daily basis. It's the truth that I was not a very good person in the process of all that, even after I stopped using, because I came in here with some ideals and some behaviors that weren't going to allow me to live as a part of mainstream society. You know, my honesty was conditional. It was based on what you was going to give me, when you was going to give it to me, how it was going to make me feel, or how it was going to make you feel. And so I had to learn the difference, you know. And in the process of learning the difference, the principles and the things that became important was, you know, a lot better. You know, I could lift my head up and look in the mirror. And I'm talking about I was in this program for 3 years doing service work, you know, going to meetings every day. And I sit back and I can see not only what my process was, but I can see some of the same processes in some of the people's lives that were around me. You know, as long as we was going to meetings every day, and it had become a social event. You know, we was going to meet at the same meeting spots. We was going to go to the same functions. We was going to do the same things. And after the dances was over, we was all going to go to the same breakfast house, and we was going to stay out till 4 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night, Saturday morning. And then I was going to wake up 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was going to go back through to the repetitive behavior once again. A deadly cycle clean is far worse than a deadly cycle using for me. It can really mess a guy like me up because I think I'm a deep thinker, and I go inside on you quick, and I won't tell you what I'm feeling, you know, and I won't let you in because if I let you in and you don't live up to my expectation, I'm hurt once again. And I don't like being vulnerable. I don't like having to tell you that I am feeling humbled in my situation right now. You know, having to come down here don't get me wrong, I thank God for the people he placed in my life, but I've been unemployed since November. And I'm a guy who prides himself on being able to take care of himself and not ask for help. And I had to come to my friends and people that are in my network and say, I'm not going to Ocean City. And they came to me and said, well, what do you need to go? You know, I had to go and tell them what I needed to go. And then I had to be humble enough to accept that they wanted to do this with no strings attached. Because I sometimes still think that if I do something for you or you do something for me, there's got to be something underneath all of what you're doing on the surface. You know, I won't just let you do it out of the kindness of the heart because I have a hard time receiving just good compliments. You know, so I'm dealing with the issues of my life and I'm dealing with the process that I go through to get to where I am so that I can still be, you know, go through this process of growing up. I used for 24 years and I didn't know the devastation that was going on in my life. You know, and it all started, you know, as fun and, you know, and fitting in. But at the end of it all, I was using to live. I was using to wake up in the morning and to go to sleep at night. I was using in the middle of the day just to get me through the day. There was not a time that I could not remember when I didn't have to have something to make me be able to cope with my life in the way that it was. And no wonder I couldn't sustain relationships because it was a result of who I was and not understanding me. You know, and so now I'm in a program that's going to allow me to learn me, cultivate me, get in relationships that are going to help me grow, and I still sometimes want to reject that? That is crazy. I'm here to tell you, man, I am so grateful. You know, my higher power is working on me. He's doing some things in me that, you know, I still, after being here all the time that I've been here, that I still don't understand. And I have to be open to receive it and accept it when it comes. You know, I never want to go back to that state of not using and not growing. Because it will kill the inside. It will kill the hope. And the hope is the light of the program for me. If the light goes out, what's left? If I don't thirst, if I don't hunger for something that's going to keep me coming back, you know, whether it's relationships with new people, whether it's sponsoring somebody, whether it's allowing my sponsor who I've had for 20 years to keep on sponsoring me, whether it's the guys who I call my family in recovery to still be a part of my family and be truthful with where I am and what I am at the time that I'm going through, then I've not given this program a chance to really work. Today, I really want to give this program a chance to work. Today, I want to just grow up, and I want to be happy, you know, and I want to have better relationships. I want to have better relationships with my siblings. You know, I'm grateful that my parents got to see me clean for a number of years. You know, I want to have better relationships on that next job that I get. You know, I want to have better relationships with just addicts down here. I want to be able to sit in a meeting and listen to you share and not be judgmental because of where I am, because of my status today. See, that's growth for me. And for me to stand up here and tell you that right now, it's for me to understand that there's some things going on that I still need to do. I still have to go to meetings. I still have to keep doing the work. I still have to let you people in my life, even when I don't want you in my life. No, I am not unique today. I thought I was when I got here. But contrary to all evidence, I'm just a dope fiend who, if I don't know what the circumstances is, but I pray to God that it never happened. If the right circumstances came up, I would be functioning with using behavior because using behavior is an area of comfort for me. You know, it's like comfort food. You know that food that we get that we like. You know that special food that you hide in the back of the refrigerator. You know. You know, that thing that we, you know, okay, you know, ain't nobody else here. I done fed the masses. Now let me go get mine, my stash. You know, that's dope fiend behavior for a guy like me. Because, see, when I used, I always kept a little piece to the side so that when you gone, when yours was gone, when you were gone, I still had a little bit left for me. And so, you know, I can't afford those areas of comfort when it's detrimental to my living or how I live. You know, when it's going to kill me at the end. So today, I am grateful that I have an opportunity to change once again. I'm grateful that I have an opportunity to continue to grow. I'm grateful that my higher power just, you know, shook the truth out of me and let me talk about me, because I was going to be real comfortable with coming down here this weekend and not doing anything. You know, and I was fighting the urges sitting over there because I really didn't want to come up here and do it. I wanted somebody else to do it. But, you know, if two people ask you to do the same thing at different times and they don't know they asked you, that's God telling you what you need to be doing. And so I'm here right now standing up before you, and I'm happy that I'm here standing up before you, and using is not an option. You know, I'm not going to throw in the towel. You know, I still think that I got a shot at the title. You know, I can win the whole thing, you know. You know, and I don't have to have that comfort food or that comfort stash. You know, I'm not better than anybody else. I'm just an addict who knows his limitations today. You know, so, you know, I want to thank you all for listening to me. Thanks for letting me share.